Okay, this is a reading for paleobiology class. It's chapter 4 in a textbook. The chapter is titled Limits to Knowledge of the Fossil Record and Their Influence on Studies of Evolution. Looks like the textbook is from 1997 and the author's last name is Carol, apparently. The edges of the pages are kind of blurred in the photocopy, so we'll see how this goes. Introduction. Modern studies of evolution at the population level support most of the conclusions reached by Darwin. In particular, natural selection has shown to be an effective force in altering the phenotype and the underlying allele frequency at least over time scales of up to hundreds of years. Plant and animal breeding shows the great potential for response to selection at a much higher rate than is known to occur in the fossil history of major groups. There is no evidence that inherent factors of development or genetic homeostasis limit the amount of change within species. However, even at this scale, the nature and extent of evolutionary change can be seen to be restricted by factors of the physical and biological environment. The dimensions of the breaks in the Galapagos finches' beaks are the beaks of the Galapagos finches are ultimately limited by the size of the seeds on which they feed. Once an optimal size is reached, change ceases unless the size or hardness of the seeds continues to change or the available food is replaced by other sources. The size of the birds and their beaks is also constrained by the presence of other potentially competing finch species. The primary factor limiting the study of evolution in modern populations is one of time. Even the fastest evolving forms do not depart from the general pattern of their ancestors over the entire history of humans. The most disparate dog or cattle breeds are members of the same species, and intermediate forms have the potential to interbreed. The complete process of speciation cannot be observed within modern populations, even over the entire span of human history. Although some modern species may be less than 1,000 years old, there are no cases in which the entire lifespan of a species can be traced. The origin of new major new structures, body plans, and ways of life have few, if any, counterparts or changes observed in modern populations. These can only be studied through the fossil record. Limitations of the fossil record. To a biologist, it may appear a simple matter to establish the patterns of evolution within the history of a species through careful collection and dating of fossils. In fact, the nature of geological processes places inherent limits on both the initial preservation of fossils and their potential for accurate dating that greatly restrict our capacity to study evolutionary patterns at the level of populations and species. Only a small fraction of the number of species that now live are known from the fossil record, and very few species are known from sequences of fossils demonstrating their morphology during successive periods of time. Before presenting specific data documenting patterns of evolution, it is necessary to discuss the limits of resolution throughout the fossil record and how they have influenced evolutionary thought. Growth of knowledge of the fossil record. Awareness that fossils are the remains of once living organisms goes back at least as far as the writings of Xanthos of Sardis, who lived 500 years before Christ. But it was not until the late 18th century that fossils began to contribute to evolutionary thought. The discovery in the 18th and early 19th century of dinosaurs, gigantic marine reptiles, and distinctive mammals that did not belong to living species showed that many animals that once lived on Earth had become extinct. These discoveries raised the possibility that there had been a succession of different types of organisms during the history of life. Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck, 1744 to 1829, demonstrated that invertebrate fossils discovered in the Paris Basin showed a progressively higher percentage of modern forms in beds that accumulated from the Eocene to the Pliocene. He concluded that this was the result of progressive evolutionary change. On the other hand, the early paleontologists Georges Cuvier, 1769 through 1832, Richard Owen, 1804 through 1892, and Louis Agassiz, probably French, 1807 to 1873, were not convinced that the fossil record supported the idea of evolutionary change. The Canadian paleontologist John William Dawson, in his Modern Ideas of Evolution, 1890, attributed the succession of different dominant life forms during the Earth's history to a series of creations and extinctions. By the time Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, a considerable variety of fossils were known, representing many major groups of extinct animals and plants, but they did not document progressive change within particular lineages or transitions between any of the major kinds of organisms. Darwin lamented that the inadequate knowledge of the fossil record in two chapters, but assumed that fossils would eventually confirm his hypothesis. His diagrammatic representation of evolutionary patterns over short and long time spans was strictly hypothetical. The late 19th century was a time of extensive fossil collecting, especially in the American West, leading to the discovery of a great variety of dinosaurs and Cenozoic mammals. Lineages such as those of fossil horses and elephants appeared to show progressive change over long periods of time with extensive modification of the skeleton, leading, as Darwin postulated, to very different body forms. Thomas Huxley used these discoveries to argue forcibly for the acceptance of evolutionary theory. By the early 20th century, nearly all biologists and paleontologists accepted that the diversity of life on Earth was the result of evolutionary change over millions of years of its history. In contrast, few influential scientists accepted Darwin's theory of natural selection as an explanation for the process of evolutionary change. In fact, the fossil record was still far too incomplete to determine the rate or pattern of change within individual species that would be necessary to evaluate Darwin's theory of natural selection. The horse fossils that so effectively documented large-scale evolutionary change were separated from one another by tens of millions of years. Forms such as Hyracotherium, in brackets Eohippus, Mesohippus, Parahippus, and Pliohippus reach very distinct from one another, with few, if any, intermediates. Any pattern evolution could have been postulated for the intervening lineages. It might have been a slow and steady progression, which seemed to be implied from a superficial interpretation of Darwin's writings, or highly irregular in pattern and rate. Darwin's only limiting condition was that evolution acted gradually in the sense of showing no marked changes between generations. Quote, natura non facit saltum. Unquote. I assume that's Latin. I guess the C should have probably been a hard C, but then no one pronounces Latin right these days anyway. Even the presence of very large gaps between particular morphological patterns resulting from saltational change could not be precluded by what was known of the fossil record in the 19th century, nor, for that matter, in many lineages as they are known today. Some paleontologists emphasized apparently sudden anatomical changes within fossil lineages and elaborated saltationist theories of evolution, Schindel-Wolf, 1950, whereas others were impressed with long-term, apparently unidirectional evolution and postulated inherently driven orthogenetic factors that would control the direction of evolution in a teleological manner. Increasing knowledge of classical and population genetics during the 20th century was shown by Dovzhansky, Mayer, Simpson to support the major precepts. Precepts? That one's cut off. Of Darwinian selection theory. Neither orthogenesis nor saltational changes of the nature proposed by late 19th and early 20th century paleontologists is consistent with what is now known of the way in which change occurs in the genetic material at either the molecular or chromosomal level. Wow, this is not the easiest to follow writing. Natural selection had become accepted by most paleontologists by the 1940s. Unfortunately, the fossil record was still too incompletely known to demonstrate the actual pattern of evolutionary change within species that would be necessary to determine the nature of the response of populations to natural selection. Two very influential books by Simpson, Tempo and Mode in Evolution, 1944, and The Major Features of Evolution, 1953, established the contributions of paleontology to the evolutionary synthesis. They also illustrated limits to the study of evolution resulting from inadequacies of our knowledge of the fossil record at the time. In Tempo and Mode in Evolution, Simpson was forced to deal with many major problems in a largely... I lost my spot. Theoretical and qualitative rather than quantitative. Attention was focused on the potential for the discoveries of the Mendelian and population genetics to explain the patterns of evolution at all levels, but detailed cases from the fossil record were not available. Simpson was unable to cite any examples to illustrate evolutionary patterns within species. Rates and patterns of evolution were discussed at the level of genera, but even at this level of the fossil record was so incompletely known that the genus appeared as an essentially typological entity. The lack of evidence for the origin and specific relationships of groups at all taxonomic levels was discussed at length. Simpson introduced the concept of quantum evolution in an effort to explain why there was so little evidence of intermediate forms linking species or higher taxa that occupied different adaptive zones. He felt that such evolutionary shifts must have occurred rapidly within small populations that had little chance of being preserved as fossils. The major features of evolution was the latest attempt by a vertebrate paleontologist to provide a unified picture of evolutionary theory. Simpson took advantage of the increased knowledge of the fossil record since the writing of Tempo and Mode, something the degree of temporal and phylogenetic resolution was not much greater, probably, but. Numerous publications supporting and elaborating the conclusions of the evolutionary synthesis have been published subsequently, but no major changes in the general concept of evolutionary patterns or processes are evident from the early 1950s. Are evident from the early 1950s. There's a lot cut off there. The publication of Eldrich and Gould's paper on punctuated equilibria in 1970-something. A bunch cut off. In contrast with the assumption of Simpson and other paleontologists that the fossil record was still far too incompletely known to provide direct evidence of evolutionary patterns at the level of species, they argued that what was already known of the remains of countless species accurately reflected their actual patterns of evolution, and that this pattern was not entirely different from that postulated by Darwin and accepted by most modern biologists. Eldrich and Gould declared that the morphological gaps between species seen in the fossil record were not simply a result of gaps in sedimentary processes, but an accurate reflection of rapid change taking place in small populations that were geographically separated from the ancestor lineage. They emphasized the great longevity of individual species and the continuing absence of any well-documented fossil evidence of changes within species to argue that natural selection was incapable of producing progressive evolutionary modification within species. Both the sudden appearance of new species and the long-term stasis within species emphasized by Eldrich and Gould on the basis of the fossil record appeared sharply at odds with observations of modern species. Their ideas were so controversial that an entire generation of paleontologists have devoted their energies to either substantiate or refute them. Whole issues of the journals Special Papers in Paleontology, 1985, and Paleobiology, 1983, Volume 3, Brackets 4, were devoted to data bearing on these topics. The most important aspect of this work was a change in emphasis in paleontology to studies of evolution at the species level. This work is now beginning to provide the link between microevolutionary patterns and processes in living species with the larger scale evolutionary patterns that can be studied only from the fossil record. Detailed information from that record should serve to test whether patterns and rates of evolution over tens of thousands and millions of years differ significantly from those observed in modern populations. The capacity of the fossil record to test any theory regarding the patterns and processes of evolution depends on the accuracy of measuring the rates of evolution. This, in turn, depends on both the completeness of the fossil record and the ability to date fossils accurately and over short time intervals. The probability of fossilization and the irregularity of sedimentation. Many scientific endeavors have practical and/or theoretical limitations. In paleontology, there are limits to what can be learned from the fossil record that are fundamental to the nature of the geologic processes. Knowledge of these limitations is necessary to understand what one can expect to learn from evolutionary patterns, both at the level of species and for larger-scale evolutionary phenomena. As a result of predation, scavenging, and decay, only a tiny fraction of the organisms that once lived are fossilized. Simpson, 1944, suggested that perhaps as many as 1 in 5,000 members of a particular vertebrate species might be fossilized in especially productive horizons. In some marine deposits, there may be millions of specimens of common invertebrates such as brachiopods, ammonites, bivalves, but other species are represented by only one or two specimens. An informative example involving lower Triassic ammonoids is provided by Smith and Patterson in a date I cannot read. of 1,194 species named from this interval, 46% were known from only a single specimen and 20% from two specimens. We have no way of knowing how many ammonoid species may have existed during this time for which no specimens have yet been found. Compilation of a Variety of Marine Taxa by Raup and Sepkoski, 1986, ranging in age from mid-Permian to Pleistocene, showed that 38% of 9,250 genera were restricted to a single horizon. And an example including including echinoderms and fish from the same interval, Smith and Patterson found that 68% of the species came from a single horizon. Nothing can be said about the pattern of evolution in species known from a single horizon, but such organisms do give an indication of the probable absence of other species, and the likely incomplete nature of the fossil record of other taxa. For the entire geological timescale, Raup, 1987, estimated that approximately 250,000 species are currently known from fossils. He estimated this with Simpson's 1952 estimate of the total number of species that lived as 50 billion. The fossilization and long-term preservation of organic remains require that they be buried by sediments to prevent further physical, chemical, and biological breakdown. Water within sediments typically carries soluble minerals such as calcium carbonate and silica that can infiltrate the openings in bones, shells, and woody material and enable them to be preserved with a little subsequent alteration in structure or histology. The rate and degree of continuity of sedimentation are hence of extreme importance in determining whether or not organisms will be preserved as fossils and how accurately the fossils represent the pattern and rate of evolution within a species. The absence of fossils may reflect the absence not of particular groups of animals or plants, but simply the appropriate conditions for their preservation. Rates of sedimentation are extremely irregular in all depositional environments. Schindel, 1982, compiled data on rates of sedimentation from 25,000 deposits ranging from recent sediments to some that have been accumulating for over more than 100 million years. That seems redundant. These examples cover eight major environments: rivers, deltas, coastal wetlands, reefs, and shallow water carbonates, bays and lagoons, inland seas, and bathyal abyssal zones. The most general feature in all of these environments is that the rate of sedimentation is inversely proportional to the time over which it occurs. Sedimentation may be very rapid over short intervals, but over long ones it is reduced or interrupted by periods of non-deposition of varying length. That's very confusingly worded. The problems of determining rates of deposition and degrees of completeness of sedimentary structures over different time intervals are further discussed by Anders, Kruger, and Sadler, 1987. One may think of oceans as being areas of long-term continuous deposition, but even in deep basins, the rate of sedimentation is governed by the relief of the nearest land and the amount of exposure of coastal areas. These differences are of sufficient magnitude to alter the apparent pattern of evolution between gradual and punctual. In depositional environments, that would be expected to preserve terrestrial vertebrates, such as overbank and floodplain deposits or deltas. Deposition may be initiated and terminated on a seasonal or sporadic basis, depending on climate and weather. Much more time may be represented by gaps between periods of deposition than by sediments. At a larger scale, marine transgressions and regressions lasting hundreds of thousands or millions of years may leave large gaps in the fossil record of both shallow marine and nearshore terrestrial communities. Deposition may be continuous for short periods, but the longer the time involved, the more numerous are larger scale gaps, and thus the average rate of sedimentation appears progressively lower. Stasis, phyletic gradualism, and punctuated change differ in the degree to which they can be established from stratigraphic records of fossils. Stasis is potentially the simplest phenomenon to demonstrate, since two fairly complete fossils separated by a significant stratigraphic interval are sufficient to establish that continuous directional change had not occurred. Even if morphological change were discovered in fossils of the same species preserved within the interval between them, it would not falsify this conclusion if stasis is defined as an oscillation about a mean. Here's some figures that are probably worth looking at later. I'm not going to try to describe them. Long-term directional change can also be readily demonstrated for organisms preserved in deposits resulting from continuous, relatively rapid sedimentation. In contrast, it is very difficult to disprove that an apparently punctuated pattern was not actually the result of an interrupted stratigraphic record of phyletic gradualism. One can imagine a situation in which short periods of rapid and continuous deposition are separated by long stretches without deposition. The periods of rapid deposition might have a rich assemblage of fossils, but from such a short period of time that little evolutionary change is evident. This case would give the impression of a strongly punctuated pattern, even if the evolution had actually occurred at a slow and constant rate for the entire sequence. Since all sedimentation is to some degree irregular and episodic, there is an inherent bias toward a punctuational pattern, any mode other than stasis. That's blurry. On the other hand, it is unlikely that alternating methods, periods, not sure, of deposition and non-deposition would be such as to produce the impression of gradualistic change from a truly punctuated pattern. The extreme rarity of gradualistic change cited by Eldridge and Gould argues strongly against a bias in that direction. There are several ways in which gaps in a sedimentary sequence can be determined, but it is much more difficult to estimate their duration. It is frequently possible to recognize surfaces that have been exposed to erosion, desiccation, or soil formation. Marked changes in lithology may also suggest intervening periods of non-deposition and changes in deposition rate. Deposits of the same total thickness may result from different length of periods of deposition or from gaps of different duration and would give the appearance of different patterns of evolution. From knowledge of a number of sedimentary sequences within the same formation, it may be possible to establish the most probable pattern for the evolving species. This appears to be the most effective in deep-sea deposits that can be studied from many drill cores. Schindler's data show that different depositional environments differ consistently in their completeness over a wide span of time intervals. Varved Lake deposits show particularly regular depositional sequences that may represent yearly increments. This would seem an ideal circumstance to study evolutionary change. Unfortunately, lakes commonly last relatively short periods of time. For example, the large Rift Valley lakes of East Africa and comparable lakes from the Triassic and early Jurassic of North America are subject to periodic drying up, with cycles of approximately 20,000 or 100,000 years associated with regional and climatic changes. The climatic changes are linked to the Milankovitch cycles, changes in the orientation of Earth's axis of rotation, the eccentricity of its orbit. The period during which these lakes could be inhabited is long enough for some of the accumulation of speciation and adaptation to different feeding modes, and some species show considerable structural change. But there is only limited evidence of the lineages surviving beyond the lakes in which they evolved. In the case of such lakes, the end of the depositional cycle not only interrupts the fossil record, but results in the extinction of nearly all the contained lineages. In the relative completeness of the fossil record over time. The problem of incomplete sedimentary sections is common to all geological periods. The longer the section studied, the greater the missing portion, but this problem may be no greater in the Paleozoic than in the Tertiary, since sedimentary processes within a particular environment were essentially the same. On the other hand, the chance of erosion or tectonic activity resulting in the loss or inaccessibility of the sedimentary sequences increases progressively with age. Whole continents may be lost to subduction or under lithospheric plates. Very few areas of the Earth's crust that formed more than 3.5 billion years ago are still present and accessible to geologists. The older the fossils, the less likely they are to survive and be collected, no matter how numerous or widespread they may have been in life. Even though the fossil record of vertebrates began only about 500 years ago, particular periods of time in their faunas remain extremely poorly known. Ordovician vertebrates, limited primarily to nearshore marine deposits, are known from only three major sites, one each in Australia and North and South America. There are few, if any, deposits from Paleozoic age from which it is possible to study evolutionary patterns at the species level, at least among vertebrates. There are many rich localities with a diversity of species, but most have very limited time spans. Only very general patterns of the radiation of major groups can be established. During the Carboniferous, when the first major radiation of amphibians and reptiles occurred, only about 20 important fossil localities have yielded a fauna of terrestrial vertebrates. Most are restricted to less than a square mile in extent and are located almost exclusively in North America and Europe, limited to a narrow band only a few degrees from the paleo equator. Nearly all species are known from only a single horizon. The temporal extent of most of the horizons has not been estimated, but Oxbow Lakes, which constitute the depositional environment at Linton, Ohio, Jarrow, Ireland, and Nirony, Czech Republic, normally last 1,000 to 10,000 years before filling with sediments. The lake system at East Kirkland, Scotland, is thought to have existed for no more than about 40,000 years. Other horizons may have similarly been limited in time. Emitting the Stephanian at the very end of the Pennsylvanian, Carboniferous deposits bearing terrestrial vertebrates may represent less than 1% of the total duration of the period. That is, more than 99% of the time elapsed is not represented by any fossils of terrestrial vertebrates. Because of gaps in the fossil record in the Carboniferous, it is still impossible to determine the interrelationships of most lineages of amphibians that have been described. For the Mesozoic, the interrelationships of major groups are better established, but very few species are sufficiently well known for detailed comparison to be made between specimens from successive horizons or different localities. Only in exceptional circumstances, such as varved lake deposits, is it possible to study populations representing a great many short time intervals within the duration of a particular species. Only from these localities is it possible to describe the pattern of evolution within particular lineages over much of the duration of the species. Although dinosaurs appear to be a well-known assemblage, there are very few cases in which remains of a particular species are known from deposits that succeed one another in time, or in which evolution at the species level has been studied. Work by Horner, Verricchio, hey, I know those guys, and Goodwin, 1992, is unique to showing what may be interpreted as anagenetic transformations between the genera. I guess we could add Scanella's name to that list now. Deposits between the Upper Cretaceous to Medicine Formation covering less than 500,000 years show 4 examples of transitions between previously recognized genera from underlying and overlying strata. The long time interval during which erosion and destructive tectonic processes could have acted since deposition will always limit the number of localities for which studies are possible within the Mesozoic. Within the Cenozoic, we have a much more complete knowledge of the overall stratigraphic record, especially in North America. This is summarized in a comprehensive volume edited by Woodburn, 1987, Cenozoic Mammals of North America, Geochronology and Biostratigraphy. See also Woodburn, 1996. According to Lindsay and Tedford, 1990, page 609, quote, North American land mammal ages now come very close to representing all of Cenozoic time, unquote. They have their issues, though. This degree of completeness has enabled many studies of evolution at the level of species and genera. Nevertheless, detailed studies of sedimentary processes indicate that even in the tertiary, there is a limit to the level of dependable resolution. For the fluvial deposits in which many tertiary mammals are found, no succession of fossils can be dated within less than approximately 10,000 years, and few can be dated consistently within intervals of less than 100,000 years. Processes of original deposition, reworking of sediments, and collection on surfaces subject to erosion result in time averaging of individual fossils over spans of up to tens of thousands of years. Gingrich, 1987, and references cited therein, has studied the patterns of evolution in a number of mammalian lineages preserved in the Paleocene and Eocene deposits. For example, in 1976, he described the phylogenetic patterns of 3 genera of primitive placental mammals from the early Eocene Willward Formation in Wyoming, based on samples from 58 relatively evenly spaced horizons within a 550-meter section. He concentrated on changes in dimension of the first lower molar tooth, which showed progressive increases or decreases over time in both within and between successive species. Cases of branching speciation were also postulated, maybe? Subsequent studies of the conditions of sedimentation at these localities by Dingus and Sadler, 1982, indicated that one could depend on some sedimentation occurring within a period of a million years. A 4 in 7 chance of it occurring within each 100,000-year interval, and a 1 in 2 chance within 10,000-year intervals. Extensive collection may result in the discovery of additional fossils, but it would not result in a finer temporal resolution. At this level of completeness, Dingus and Sadler conclude that we would not expect to resolve evolutionary processes lasting less than hundreds of thousands of years. Gaps within fossil lineages of shorter duration might result from the lack of deposition and have no evolutionary significance. Gingrich, 1982 and 1987, subsequently worked in other areas within the Eocene, in which the rates of deposition were up to twice as rapid as the Willward Formation. Nevertheless, he concluded that the biological processes that occurred on a temporal scale of less than 5,000 to 10,000 years were effectively beyond resolution in the fluvial deposits in which most tertiary mammals were found. With an exceptionally long and continuous stratigraphic record, it should be possible to date fossils from several intervals within the length of species duration, yet in practice, this is rarely the case, even in the tertiary. The vagaries of preservation, the irregularities of deposition, and the infrequent availability of beds that can be used for radiometric dating still make it difficult to establish whether the rarity or absence for fossils linking species is a consequence of punctuated evolutionary pattern or a result of geological factors, even in the mid-Cenozoic. Even at the level of relationships between species and genera, the fossil record of Cenozoic mammals shows many conspicuous gaps. This is clearly demonstrated by a recent phylogeny of middle Miocene horses, illustrated by McFadden, 1992. Although these horses are an extensively studied group with a rich fossil record in North America, many well-documented lineages remain separated from one another by gaps of millions of years, well beyond the probable duration of speciation events. For example, there's a gap of more than 3 million years at the base of lineage 4, and another of 2.5 million years in the lineage postulated as the common ancestor of lineages 4 and 5. There is no fossil record at all of the lineages involved in 5 successive speciation events leading to lineages 6 and 17, covering a time span of more than half a million years. These breaks in the fossil record may result from gaps in sedimentary sequences or reflect the absence of horses in particular geographic areas or environments. They provide no information at all regarding evolutionary processes. Dating geological events and processes. As knowledge of the fossil record has improved, so have methods to date events in the Earth's history and within evolution of fossil groups. Despite the limits of precision in establishing the age of fossils and the length of time between fossiliferous horizons on the basis of thickness of sediments, emphasized early in this chapter, this method remains one of the most widely used for dating individual fossils in the field. It also continues to form the primary basis for estimating the rates of evolutionary processes within species. Fossils themselves have long been used as a means of dating stratigraphic horizons. By the early 19th century, it was recognized that different fossil assemblages typically occurred in a particular sequence within geological strata, which served as a basis for establishing their relative age. The major units of the currently interpreted fossil geological timescale were established initially on the basis of a succession of fossil-bearing strata. Even without knowledge of their age and years, the preservance or absence of particular species allowed geologists to establish relative congruence, maybe, of a great number of subdivisions within each larger unit. Some of these subunits are now known to last no more than a few hundred thousand years, providing a very effective means of dating over large areas of the planet. Dating fossil vertebrates frequently depends on their association with fossils of invertebrates or plants, especially pollen and spores, that can be dated relative to other geological horizons. Fossil vertebrates themselves are used to establish the major, I have no idea what that word is, major blank of terrestrial Cenozoic deposits in North America and Europe, maybe? Although fossils may serve as the basis for reconstructing, I'm going to guess, particular stratigraphic horizons, independent means of dating in years independent means of dating in years must be established in order to determine rates and patterns of evolution. I'm not sure if I got that right. Radiometric dating. The first widely accepted effort to apply laws of physics to dating Earth was undertaken late in the 19th century by Lord Kelvin, who calculated the probable age of the world on the assumption that it had cooled progressively from the molten state. His date of approximately 12 million years was a serious blow to evolutionary theory, being far shorter than Darwin and others thought necessary for the gradual unfolding of change and diversification. Ironically, the reason that Lord Kelvin's suggestion for a very short history of Earth was incorrect. I'm going to try that one again. Ironically, the reason that Lord Kelvin's suggestion for a very short history of Earth was incorrect, the fact that its heat had been maintained by the decay of radioactive elements, was also the basis for establishing a correct age. Radioactive decay has generated sufficient heat to maintain the Earth's temperature at a nearly constant level for more than 4 billion years. Soon after the discovery of radioactivity by Becquerel in the late 1890s, it was recognized that radioactive decay occurred at a nearly constant rate. By 1913, when his Age of the Earth was published, Arthur Holmes had used the decay of uranium to lead to provide the first estimates of the planet's age based on an absolute timescale. This was to provide a dependable framework for the timing of all geological events in the history of life on Earth. Except for C14, whose decay is so rapid that it can be used for dating events only in the past 50,000 to 70,000 years, isotopes used in radiometric dates are associated primarily with volcanic and other igneous rocks. Most fossils are dated indirectly by their presence in beds immediately above or below beds that have few or no fossils of their own, but do contain isotopes that can be dated. A number of different elements have been used for radiometric dating, but most currently accepted dates were established from the 40 potassium to 40 argon decay. These isotopes can be studied effectively in both lava flows and ash falls. The latter provide an especially useful means of dating fossils in the Cenozoic of North America. They were frequent and widespread and may be closely associated with beds containing vertebrates. As with our knowledge of the fossil record, the accuracy of radiometric dating progressively lessens as one goes back into the geological record, and fewer dates have been established. Use of potassium-argon decay can date with an uncertainty of only 1 to 2%, and the more recently developed 40-argon to 39-argon decay has an uncertainty as small as 0.1%. The latter method is very accurate for events over periods of tens of thousands to a million years. For events occurring 10 million years ago, the expected error is approximately 10,000 years, which is equivalent to the highest expected resolution for most stratigraphic sequences. For the early Cenozoic, the best possible dating yields an expected error of approximately 65,000 years, or a current practical limit applied to the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary of 100,000 years. Although this is within the range of most species' longevity, it would not suffice to track differences at the level of populations, and may be shorter than the period during which speciation occurs. For short time intervals in the early part of the Tertiary, radiometric dating is less accurate than estimates based on sedimentary processes. Magnetostratigraphy. Another method of dating, which does not itself become progressively less accurate with time, is magnetostratigraphy. The polarity of Earth's magnetic field has been reversed many times in the planet's history, over very irregular intervals of time. The timing of reversals is dependent on something dating of associated strata, The determination of the time in one place is sufficient, maybe, for correlation with other beds showing the event everywhere on Earth. Something the shift in polarity affects the entire planet simultaneously. Polarity may either be normal, as it is at present, or reversed, with the needle of the compass pointing south rather than north. The relative duration of the episodes is sufficiently irregular that their sequence can be correlated in widely separate areas, just as one can date events through comparison of irregular spacing of tree something. Changes in magnetic polarity have the advantage of being detectable in any sediments containing ferromagnetic minerals, whereas rocks appropriate for radiometric dating are only rarely deposited in close association with beds containing fossils. The average duration of each period of normal or reverse polarity during the Cenozoic is approximately 330,000 years. For this time interval, potassium-argon dates are something average only about 200,000 years apart, but they are directly applicable to only a something geographical area. A small number of more accurate dates may be achieved by concentrating on the time of the reversal, which takes only 5,000 to 10,000 years. So the age of the small percentage of fossils that overlap a change in polarity can be dated very accurately, no matter how long ago the reversal occurred. However, much less than 1% of fossils can be expected to be datable with this level of accuracy. Moreover, this method provides only one date rather than the minimum of two brackets for the duration of biological processes such as speciation or anagenetic change. Paleomagnetic reversals have been extensively studied as far back as the early Jurassic, but most of the Cretaceous is dominated by a single polarity, so that provides no significant date lines. For the Paleozoic, little information is yet available except for the dominantly reverse polarity recognized for the Upper Carboniferous and Permian. Rates of evolution. Radiometric and paleomagnetic dating provides an effective basis for determining the age of fossils, and hence rates of evolution of the species to which they belong. Quantitative study of evolutionary rates began with Simpson, 1944, 1953, and Haldane, 1949. Simpson discussed three major ways to measure the rate of evolution: genetic, morphological, and taxonomic. Morphological change. The most obvious measure is in terms of quantitative difference in morphological features as seen in sequence of fossils. This was formalized by Haldane, 1949, in terms of the equation R equals brackets LN. I don't remember what that means. And then parentheses x2 end parentheses minus ln parentheses x1 end parentheses end bracket divided by parentheses t1 minus t2 end parentheses, where r is the rate of change, x1 is the initial dimension, and x2 is the final dimension of the character, and t1 minus t2 is the amount of time between the ages of x1 and x2. Haldane expressed the rate in Darwin's d, the amount of change per million years. Linear measures are transformed to natural logarithms to minimize the effect of absolute size, so that valid comparisons can be made between organisms of very different size. Measurements in Darwin's have been made in hundreds of different taxa, fossil and living, and show a great range of different rates both within and between groups. It was originally assumed that the rate of evolution might be similar within particular groups, e.g. faster in mammals than in clams, but might differ during different periods of evolution, e.g. faster during the origin of a group and slower during subsequent periods, thus furnishing a comparable means of measuring rates over all spans of geological time. Work by Curtin suggested that for mammals, rates were higher during the Pleistocene than in the Tertiary, and higher yet in the Holocene, recent. He attributed this difference to more powerful selection in the Pleistocene and Holocene in relationship to periodic glaciation and the radical changes since the retreat of the last continental glaciers. A radically different interpretation was given by Gingrich, 1983, on the basis of a compilation of five, some number that begins with five, and then increments, maybe that word is increments, made over a great range of different time spans, from 1.5 years to something million years. He discovered a strongly negative correlation between the span of time over which change was measured and the apparent rate of evolution. Something typical rate of 0.1 Darwin's in fossils for an average of 60,000 Darwin's in laboratory selected experiments. He argued that the apparently very slow rates in fossil groups can be attributed to averaging out changes that might be very rapid for short periods of time, but were of short duration, and so would appear to be much slower if measured during long periods. Something illustrated this graphically through an example of changes in the Eocene primate, something I can't read, over different intervals of time, Gingrich, 1987. Fossils were collected from 15 horizons separated by 40,000 to 45,000-year intervals. From this sequence, he measured 14 rates of change at 40,000 to 45,000-year intervals, something rates of change between the successive 80,000 and 90,000-year intervals, 12 rates of change between 120,000 and 135,000-year intervals, and so on. The resulting something showed a normal distribution ranging from more than two Darwin's negative change, reduction in size, ranging from greater than two Darwin's negative change to greater than two Darwin's positive change. Okay. So negative change, reduction in size, positive change, increase in size. The mode is plus 0.4 Darwin's, reflecting the overall tendency towards successively larger specimens in higher horizons. Gingrich emphasized that biologically significant comparisons of evolutionary rates can only be made over equivalent periods of time. Rapid rates of evolution observed in modern populations almost certainly could not be sustained over long periods of geological time. Under unidirectional selection pressure, the trait something quickly reach an optimal or structurally limited size and cease to evolve, or something changing selection pressure might undergo reversal or long-term oscillation, thus greatly reducing the long-term rate of evolution. The use of Haldane's equation remains a practical measure of change in linear dimensions when comparing similar intervals of time. McFadden, 1992, used it extensively in his recent study of horse evolution. It must be recognized, however, that nearly all measures over short periods of time will result in high rates, whereas measures over long periods of time will imply much slower rates. As a result, evolutionary rates will superficially appear to be faster during the Quaternary and Late Tertiary, where temporal resolution is far closer than in early geological periods. Because of the problem of measuring rates of evolution over different time intervals, Haldane, 1949, suggested that the only valid measure of evolutionary rate would be from generation to generation. This was followed up by Gingrich something in proposing a new measure of evolutionary rate, the Haldane. This was described by the following equation. I'm not even going to try to read this one. One Haldane is defined as change by factors of standard deviation, i.e. one standard deviation per generation. The Haldane has a theoretical advantage over the Darwin in measuring evolutionary rates because it is based on generation time rather than years. Gingrich refers to the average change for a single generation, measuring in standard deviation as the intrinsic evolutionary rate. In common with the Darwin, the intrinsic evolutionary rate must be inversely proportional to the number of generations over which it can be measured. It can only be calculated in living populations, or for limited cases in the fossil record, such as varved lakes, from which the yearly intervals can be determined and factored into probable generation times. For most examples in the fossil record, actual intervals that can be sampled over a great many generations. Gingrich applied this procedure to length and width measurements in the lower first molar tooth in successive samples of the primitive Eocene horse Hyracotherium grangeri, for which he established that the minimum number of generations between samples was approximately 6,750. He calculated the average intrinsic rate as 0.225 H with a 95% confidence interval in the range of 0.056 to 0.870 Haldanes. This is a very broad confidence interval. In addition, the large number of generations that were averaged would give a figure far below the expected rate for some generations that exhibited high rates of change. One may compare, for example, the extremely variable intergenerational changes in metric characters among Darwin's finches in normal and in drought years. This particular example shows how the difficulty of applying this measure to the fossil record, and, on the other hand, the potential for the application of a very important measure of clear evolutionary significance across the gap between modern and fossil populations. Gingrich calculated that the intrinsic value of change in two modern populations, one involving laboratory selection in the mouse, the other natural selection in the marine snail Littorina. For the mouse, a line selected for increased body size something approximately 80% of each litter eliminated in each generation, increased on average at an average rate of 0.18 Haldanes per generation over a period of 23 generations. Study of spire reduction attributed to selection by a predatory crab in Litterina covered three intervals of 17, 69, and 86 generations with a median rate of change per generation of 0.148 Haldanes. So far, attempts to determine the intrinsic evolutionary rates have been conducted only in an extremely small number of species. Nevertheless, the preliminary results are potentially of great significance. They indicate that the amount of change from generation to generation, even when averaged over many generations, is large relative to the amount of difference that is commonly used to distinguish species from something species and species. Land, 1986, following Simpson, 1961, and Mayer, 1969, used two phenotypic standard deviations to characterize the limit of differences recognized between populations within a subspecies. Subspecies would be expected to exhibit differences greater than two phenotypic standard deviations, which is only 20 times that difference exhibited between individual genetic generations in the example studied by Gingrich. Two species of Hyracotherium, H. grangeri and H. amular, which follow one another in stratigraphic sequence in the section studied by Gingrich, differ from one another in the size of their lower first molar by 4.15 omega, standard deviations, I guess. This is only 40 times the amount of change postulated for an average intrinsic evolutionary rate, or 18 or 19 times the intrinsic evolutionary rate calculated for this character in Hyracotherium grangeri. At least 13,500 generations separate those two species, but there is no evidence of the pattern of evolution between them. Gingrich refers to this as an interval of punctuation. In the change in dimensions of the something unidirectionally, as if under selection, at a constant rate of only over 13,500 generations, the minimum duration of their stratigraphic separation, the average rate maybe would be much slower than 0.0002 Haldanes. Would be much slower, 0.0002 Haldanes, than the average rate measured over intervals of 6,750 generations in the ancestral species. I have no idea what that just said. Something extremely important observation, maybe one extremely important observation resulting from this study is that the intrinsic rate of evolution, the amount of change per generation, may be similar for all characteristics, whether their pattern of evolution over timescales of thousands or more generations shows stasis or clearly directional change, and whether they are measured within or between species. At the level of morphological changes within species, the Haldane provides a limiting measure of the rate of change, but no information regarding the direction or rate of evolutionary change at longer timescales within short-lived populations. Although the intrinsic rate of evolution is the fastest possible rate of change, in all cases, the actual rate of evolution, termed net rate of evolution by Gingrich, something slower and may appear as stasis or random walk. From these observations, Gingrich concludes that control of evolutionary rates is not inherent, since rates something from generation to generation are normally orders of magnitude faster, something necessary to account for the most rapid changes recognized over longer periods of time, even in the most stringent selection experiments. Control of the rate and direction of evolution must be extrinsic to the organism and population. Something in physical and biological aspects of the environment. Simpson and Gingrich concentrated on linear dimensions as a fundamental aspect? I don't think it's aspect. As a fundamental something of anatomical change. Changing ratios of body proportions, such as limb length versus snout vent length, or the width and breadth of the skull, are also frequently used to describe evolutionary change, but they are not amenable to expression in Darwin's or Haldane's. Bookstein et al., 1985, have developed procedures that can be used to describe change in two shapes in shape in two dimensions. Many taxa can be distinguished from one another by differences in the number of particular skeletal elements, such as vertebrae, fin rays, digits, or phalanges. These are referred to as something neuristic changes. Neuristic changes? I'm not sure. Such changes are used frequently in taxonomic definitions of groups, but not commonly as a measure of evolutionary rate among vertebrates because of the rarity of well-dated sequences. De Braga and Carroll, 1993, something the total of anatomical, maybe measured, the total of anatomical changes that occurred over a particular time, something as a measure of the relative rates of evolution and transition between two something groups and the rates of evolution within the ancestral and descendant groups. Changes in physiology and behavior are even more difficult to compare and nearly impossible to measure in a quantitative manner. Nevertheless, changes in something may have been the primary factor in such major transitions as the emergence of land vertebrates from the water and in the origin of many lineages of something-arily aquatic vertebrates. Increase in metabolic rate was certainly key to the origin of both ornithurine birds and mammals. Taxonomic rates. Another way of measuring evolution is in terms of the longevity of taxa and the rate of their origination and extinction. The rapid appearance and persistence of numerous distinct lineages is a conspicuous aspect of the early evolution of many taxonomic groups. Species, genera, families, orders, and even phyla have been used for analysis, depending on the scale of radiation. Simpson, 1944-1953, made extensive use of genera, rather than species, in evaluating evolutionary rates because of the practical limitations of the fossil record as it was known at that time. Although genera might comprise several species, more data was then available on the longevity of genera than of species, which were frequently known from single subhorizons. Subsequently, studies showed broadly similar patterns of evolution of genera and species, indicating that this procedure is appropriate for comparative studies. Closer approximation to estimating the duration of taxa can theoretically be made using species longevity, since the species has the potential for a more objective definition. See Chapter 7 for a discussion of the relative objectivity of taxa at different levels. Most studies of the longevity of taxa have been based directly on the known temporal range of fossil remains. This certainly underestimates their temporal range. Unless the fossil record reveals a speciation event that marks the end of a particular species, or that species continues to the present, it is impossible to be certain when a species actually begins and ends. The time of its origin can be estimated through analysis of relationship with its most closely related sister groups. This will nearly always indicate a significantly longer range than indicated by the fossil record directly, as demonstrated by Novasek and Norell, 1982. There is no way to be certain of the actual time of extinction, since even today, taxa that were thought to be long extinct are occasionally recognized in the modern biota. The discovery of a coelacanth in 1938, after this group was thought to have died out during the Cretaceous, is a familiar modern example, but many less well-known cases are reported from the fossil record, such as the extension of the range of the large labyrinthodont amphibians from the Triassic into the Jurassic and Cretaceous. Although the rate of taxonomic evolution can only be loosely quantified, it is a useful way to compare rates of evolution at different stages in the longevity of a particular group between related groups. For example, Hulbert and McFadden's study of horse evolution in the Middle Miocene showed that it began with very rapid speciation, followed by a steady state between origination and extinction. Molecular evolution. Simpson suggested that it might also be possible to determine the rate of evolution by measuring the total amount of genetic change between two generations within a succession of generations, Efforts to do so were made by Dobzhansky on the basis of Drosophila. Simpson, 1953, Part 4, page 4, concluded his discussion by stating, "There is little hope that fossils can ever be used for any extensive study of genetic evolution directly as such," unquote. Unfortunately, Simpson did not foresee the revolution brought about by the development of techniques that made it possible to retrieve and sequence DNA from fossils. This has made it practical to demonstrate base pair differences in small segments of particular genes in many extinct organisms, including horses, insects, and plants. Although it is potentially possible to use the amount of change between fossil and living taxa to determine the rate of change in a particular gene within the group, the rarity of fossil DNA makes this impractical as a general means of comparison, at least for the foreseeable future. The ease with which DNA and RNA can now be sequenced in living organisms does provide a means for establishing relationships and measuring relative rates of evolution in all taxonomic groups. This is particularly important in groups in which the fossil record is incompletely known and for study of the sequence something divergence of populations and subspecies living today. In common with changes in morphology, changes in DNA do not occur at the same rates in all taxa, or in the same taxa at different periods of its evolution. Mitochondrial DNA change much more rapidly than nuclear DNA, and different portions of the same something evolve more rapidly than the others. It is thus possible to select particular types of something whose rates of change are most appropriate for the time span of the problem being studied. Since there is an almost infinite amount of DNA, it is not surprising that details of phylogenies will differ depending on what genes are used. Several journals are devoted specifically to molecular studies of evolution, e.g. Journal of Molecular Evolution, Molecular Biology and Evolution, and Molecular Phylogenetics and Evolution. Molecular evidence is used primarily for establishing the nature of interrelationships of different lineages and the relative time of their divergence. By itself, it cannot establish the actual time when these lineages originated. Like other aspects of evolution, change in DNA is broadly correlated with elapsed time, but not directly so. For any particular problem, a molecular clock must be, quote, set on the something of some other evidence, such as the fossil record or a geological event. If we are fairly certain of the timing of a geological event, such as the beginning of separation of South America and Africa as a result of continental drift, we can use this information to give a minimum time for the separation of populations that inhabited those continents. The time at which their genome was identical must have been prior to that split. The total amount of change can then be divided by the elapsed time to give an approximate rate of change. If this rate is fairly constant, it can be used to establish the sequence of divergence of individual lineages within groups that subsequently evolved separately in South America and Africa. This provides information as to the rate of divergence and the relative longevity of living members of these lineages. If the evidence provided by several different genes in all the taxa being studied is consistent, it supports the initial assumption that the near constancy of rate of genetic change. So far, none of the genes that have been used in taxonomic studies provides direct evidence of the evolution of morphological structures. Although phylogenies based on molecular evidence may accurately reflect the relative time of divergence of vertebrate groups, they cannot be used to establish how or when specific characters by which we recognized members of these groups evolved. Taxonomic groups are recognized by the presence of one or more unique morphological trait by which all known members can be identified. Although the divergence in a group may be accompanied by the emergence of a clearly defined new character, it is very unlikely that more than a single character will arise in synchrony with the divergence, or that even a single character will be fully developed at this something moment, maybe. No matter how accurate the phylogenetic resolution, the fossil record remains the primary basis for the establishment of the patterns and rates of morphological change. Summary. Something clear from the nature of sedimentary processes and larger-scale geologic phenomena that the preservation of the remains of organisms is both extremely rare and extremely irregular, in contrast with studies of evolutionary patterns and something based on living populations, the paleontologist is very limited in the evidence that is available. Particular problems, such as the nature of the transition between major groups or the response at the species level to changes in the environment, must be studied on the basis of particular examples of a specific taxa over elapsed time intervals. The capacity to determine the patterns and rates of evolution is limited by the something both the number of fossils that can be recovered and our ability to date something decline progressively in older strata. Prior to the Mesozoic, wide morphological gaps separate nearly all orders of fish and amphibians. Very few adequately known species are known with certainty from more than one locality or geological horizon. In the Mesozoic, relationships between the major groups can be something accurately established, but evolution at the level of genera and species is still largely unknown. At least among terrestrial mammals, the record is far more completely known in the tertiary, with many relationships well established in the geologic, or at the generic and specific level. Generic and specific come from the words genus and species. Whoa, my mind is blown. That's probably true, unless it's vice versa. That's wild either way. Patterns of evolution within vertebrate species, in contrast, something stratigraphically beyond the resolution of sedimentary rock records and radiometric dating? I don't know what that says. Something the late Cenozoic, only a few cases can be confidently established as illustrating punctuated equilibria or phyletic gradualism. 1982 and 1990 has argued that the acceptance of the theories of punctuated equilibria and species selection depends on their quantitative dominance. Something this is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to document from fossil record. Among vertebrates, it is difficult to determine the relative importance of stasis and phyletic evolution, even for particular characters within a single species over a something period of time. Establishing the relative frequency of punctuated versus phyletic change for life as a whole, or even for mammals throughout the Cenozoic, something beyond the capacity for our current knowledge of the fossil record. And this, in something, in short maybe, is but an unknown fraction of the actual history of the species that lived within this time period. The remainder of this book deals with specific examples of patterns of evolution identified, maybe, through the fossil record. These examples were selected because they are well documented and demonstrate particular features that are important for understanding how evolution operates in different vertebrate groups and over different timescales. They also illustrate some of the difficulties common to the study of fossils. I have attempted to approach this study in a systematic manner, proceeding at the level of species to progressively higher taxonomic groups and larger scale evolutionary phenomena, but this has not always been possible. Even the largest scale evolutionary events must have begun at the level of species.